Hi, I'm Dr. Stuart Goldberg from the Leukemia Division at Hackensack University Medical Center, a little bit north of here. And it's a great pleasure to be here today and also to work with two fine organizations. 20 plus years ago when I came to New Jersey, I was actually the medical director for the Leukemia Society, and now I'm on the international board for the MDS Foundation. So if you get one of those ads, those things saying, please give, I usually have written them, since that's my job is the developmental board. So Dale's done a wonderful job of setting up, really what is MDS. I'm going to go through that again a little bit, and then I'm going to focus more on the treatment side and some of the research and talk a little about transplant. For those of you who've heard me in the past, I'm going to go a little bit faster because I have 60 plus slides. There's a lot to cover, information to cover, and I'm going to ask that we hold questions during the talk this year, which is also different for me. I'm going to stay during lunch. So I will come by the tables and you can get your questions there. But I'm going to cover a lot of stuff, and unfortunately we only have a little time. So hopefully I'll hit most of the things that you want to know, and then we can fill in during lunchtime. Also, as you heard, we will be making the slides available, so you don't have to take pictures of them. If you don't get them through the MDS Foundation, you can always call me or email me and I'll send them to you. And lastly, I was asked if you have questions. When we do have questions at the end, make sure you hit the button so that they can record and they can let everybody know what everybody else can hear it. So I'm going to go through what you really need to know about MDS, how we think about it as doctors and taking care of our patients, and also what are the therapies and what's new. So as you heard before, the myelodysplastic syndrome is not one disease. The syndromes. That means plural, and it is a group of diseases which we call the bone marrow failure disorders. And as you heard before, you make your blood inside your bones. If you think about what a dog bone looks like, that's what your bone marrow looks like. So in adults, we make most of our blood in our backsides, in our pelvic bone, and a little bit here in the sternum, and all the other bones are scarred up and you don't make blood. When you were kids, you did there. But for mostly we make it in our backsides. And what are you making there? You're making blood. Now, most people, when they hear about the word blood, they think of red stuff. And the red stuff is certainly part of the blood, and it's actually, for MDS patients, in fact, 85% of patients with MDS, it is a red cell disease. So that is, but not everybody. But for most people, red cells are inhibited. The ability to make red cells is inhibited in myelodysplasia. So what is the red stuff? Well, the red stuff is what carries oxygen. And oxygen is what your body, your muscles need. So think of a red cell as basically a truck. It goes to the lungs, picks up oxygen, your heart pushes it around, goes down to the muscles, delivers the oxygen. Muscles get fed, you have energy, you can walk and you can move. Now, if you have a bad lung, you don't get the oxygen in, you're gonna feel tired. If you have a bad heart, you don't push it around, you're gonna feel tired. You don't have blood, doesn't matter if your heart's working or your lungs aren't working, you're going to feel tired. So the question earlier, how do you define between the heart and the lung? That's tough. And so we often will have the heart doctors involved to say, is it a heart problem? Is it a blood problem? So these three pieces all have to be working for us to be able to walk up a flight of stairs. If your heart's not as good, it may mean that you need a little higher red cells to do the job. But also remember that if you have a lower red count, if you have fewer trucks making deliveries, and you need to still make deliveries, what do? You tell them to speed up. So it's very common for people who have anemia, low blood counts, to have very fast heart rates. That's normal. That's good. Your heart rate should be faster because you're trying to make the same number of deliveries with fewer trucks. And I've seen an error where I've sent one of my patients actually recently went to a heart doctor. The heart doctor saw the too fast heart rate, gave him a beta blocker to slow down the heart rate, and next thing you know, he's passing out. Because this all has to go together. And likewise, I've seen people with anemia, they will have fluid in their legs. Their legs start to swell up, and they don't like that. And they go to the family doctor, and the family doctor gives them some Lasix, some water pills, gets rid of the water, and next thing you know, they pass out. Why? Because blood pressure. If you don't have blood, you still need blood pressure, so your body will hold on to water. But water's leaky, so then you get puffy legs. So, everything, these are all related, but the idea is carry the oxygen from the lungs to the muscles. We measured in hemoglobin, so that's the thing you want to look at. There's lots of things about red on there. Don't pay attention to any of them but the hemoglobin. I don't care how many number of cells you have, RBC, that means nothing to me. Water to blood ratio, hematocrit, means nothing. Size of cells doesn't mean nothing. You want how many grams of hemoglobin, how many grams of the molecule that carries the oxygen to the muscles do you have? In men, it's 14, women, it's 12. So basically, 12 pints of blood, 14 pints of blood. I think of it in actual visual things. And so when somebody has a hemoglobin of 7, they're running on half a tank. And that's why they feel tired. Where do you start to feel tired? It's different. It's also different about what you're doing. If you sit around in the house all day and stay in your Barker lounger, well, you probably need a hemoglobin of 7 because you're not doing much. You want to walk up a flight of stairs, though, you may need a hemoglobin of 9 or 10. So it depends on how active the person is, what that cutoff is. There is no number that we give. We may give transfusions for 7 because we don't want to go below 7 and put the person at risk for a heart attack or stroke or something like that. But past that, it's really what you tell us you need to do. If you're just sitting in a lounge chair, we're not going to give you a lot of transfusions. If you're still full working every day, you probably need a higher hemoglobin. So talk to your doctor about what you feel like. We also heard about white cells earlier. So white cells are part of the blood, and there are lots of different kinds of white cells, as Dale said, but the one we care about is the neutrophil or the granulocyte. Some pronouns will say G, some will say neutrophil, some will say poly. They're all the same thing, but the polys, which are these squiggly ones over here, what they do is they fight bacteria. That's what you care about today. Yeah, lymphocytes are important for preventing infections and long-term stuff, but what do you care about right now if somebody sneezes on you? You care about that you have the ability to fight those bacteria this minute. So when those bacteria-fighting cells get low, you start getting infections. And so that's where Dr. Shah was talking about a total white count of 4,000. Once again, I don't care about the total. I care about how many do I have the bacteria-fighting cells that I need this minute. And if that gets below 1,000 on that sheet, and it'll sometimes say absolute granulocytes, absolute polys, on that sum that printout, it'll have something on there. And if you don't know where it is, ask the doctor or the nurse. Point out which one it is. When that falls below 1,000, people start to get infections more commonly. Okay? Now, interestingly, for reasons we don't understand, MDS patients can tolerate lower neutrophil counts because probably it's chronic. So we don't really actually see infections starting to occur until we almost get to about 200. So much lower than a woman with breast cancer who gets chemo and then dips quickly and then recovers. During that quick dip, they're much more at risk for infection than a person who chronically runs low white counts with MDS. So we don't tend to use chronic antibiotics, but there are patients of mine who we do put on them because it turns out, whatever reason, they get infections over and over again, and then we need to put them on it. So everybody's different on that. We watch the patients, but in general, we don't use a lot of antibiotics in MDS patients for the same number we might use for breast cancer or colon cancer when they get chemo. And then platelets, they're the ones that stop you from bleeding. They're the clotting cells. Now, clotting is actually two pieces. There's the bricks and the glue. If you let blood settle, the clear stuff on top is called the serum. That's the glue, but the platelets are the bricks. The bricks have to be there to stop the holes. If the platelet count's normally 200,000, if it falls to 100,000, who cares? 100,000 an operation can occur. If you get below 50, the surgeons aren't too thrilled because the cut may take a long time to stop, but it will stop. You get below 20, then all of a sudden cuts don't stop. And you get below 10, don't shake your head too much because the shaking of your head may be enough to cause a stroke. So we don't like to hear numbers in the tens or less. But if you think 200's normal, tens are real far down there. And our body really does try to keep us away from that. You'll see that very few MDS patients really get below 10. It really tries to at least keep that last little bit, okay? But as you can imagine, too few blood cells, you're gonna have no red cells, you're gonna have energy problems. No white cells, you're gonna have infection type problems. No platelets, you're gonna have bleeding problems. If you got that, you understand. So what is MDS? MDS is a disease where the bone marrow is damaged and you don't make blood. It's that simple. Now, the key is that it's damaged. It has to be damaged. There are other reasons why the bone marrow may not make blood, but in MDS, it's a disease of the factories that make blood, and they look damaged. So what can cause that damage? Well, Dr. Shah told you, it can be a lot of different things. 80%+ of the time, we throw up our heads. We say, we don't know. But sometimes people worked in the gasoline industry or petroleum industry or had hobbies with with photography and has experience to toluenes or benzenes. Those chemicals all are known. We obviously in New Jersey, the petroleum industry here, a lot of photography, graphic arts, and those type of things. Those type of chemicals are known to cause problems with damaging the bone marrow. And if you did that for many, many years, you may see MDS. You also see it in somebody who got chemotherapy. Unfortunately, like, for example, Robin Roberts got chemotherapy for breast cancer. Years later, the chemo that she got caused her to develop MDS. So anything that can damage the bone marrow. We've heard a little bit about immune diseases in this room. People who have something wrong with their immune system because of some other disease, like psoriasis or other immune diseases, well, that immune system may actually attack the bone marrow and make it not go well, or there may be some interplay between the two diseases. And then there are inherited ones. Usually these are the ones we show up in kids. So there's some weird genetic diseases, Down syndrome, for example, a very common disease, that some of the children with Down syndromes will end up having damage to their bone marrow also. How do we make the diagnosis? The dreaded bone marrow biopsy. And why do we do the bone marrow biopsy? Because the disease, by definition, is damage to the bone marrow. Just because you have low blood counts, there can be other reasons. We can think it's MDS, but unless we see damaged-looking cells, we can't call it that. So we stick a needle in the hip, and we look at the factories themselves, and you look to see, do the factories look damaged? And this is where we go to school to learn to look at those cells and say, those are ugly, and if they're ugly factories, then they don't make blood. Now, sometimes we look, and we, you know, after we take the cells out, you often see that we send it away for a couple $1,000 test. So you see on your bill, all of a sudden you get these bills for the bone marrow, the pathologist, and then you get this big bill for something called cytogenetics. And that is, we can see it looks ugly on the outside, but what does it look like on the inside of the cell? So inside all the cells are the genes. The genes are, the chromosomes are the things that tell your cell what to do. And we've learned earlier this morning, you heard that there are 46 chromosomes. I can tell you this is a woman, because the last one back here, this is an X and a Y. The X is the little tiny one, the X is the big one, the Y is the little tiny one. So this is, I take it back. If it's an X and a Y, it's got to be a boy. Okay? So this is from a boy, but basically we look, we take all the chromosomes, line them up, take pictures, and then somebody who's skilled at this will look at all those little bands and tell us that they look normal or they don't look normal. Okay? And now gradually we've learned how to do this even fancier with fancier techniques rather than just photographing it, but we look for those genetic changes. And those genetic changes will tell us how damaged the cell is on the inside. So it looks abnormal on the outside, we call it MDS, but is it damaged on the inside at a genetic level? And depending on where that gene is broken, it may tell us, yes, this is a damaged cell and it's not going to make blood, but it's also not going to disintegrate very fast. So for example, if chromosome 5 is broken, the so-called 5q- syndrome, yeah, it's damaged, it's not going to make red cells, but it's also not going to develop into leukemia, and those patients may live for 20 years with a damaged bone marrow. On the other hand, if chromosome 7 is missing, if you only have one of those chromosome 7, so count over number 7, if that one's missing, well, that's a damaged bone marrow that's going to disintegrate in under a year. So this has great prognosis information because it really tells us what's going to happen at a genetic level that then is going to tell us how fast that disease is going to progress. And we use that information to try to figure out how do we treat the person. If it's going to be a slow decline of the bone marrow, I'm not going to be very aggressive. It's going to be a fast, I don't have time. I have to get started with therapy. Now, this is new. And since I was asked to talk about research, I put the little icons. You'll see when the new things are up there. So what's new in the last 2 or 3 years? Well, we've got a whole bunch of people who are being sent to us now as hematologists that have low blood counts. And we stick a needle on their hip, and the bone marrow looks normal. Well, if it looks normal, I cannot call it MDS. That's the definition. It has to look at ugly-looking bone marrow. But they came to me because they have a low blood count. So what do I call them? Well, we have 3 new names of diseases or categories of diseases. In fact, we might even call them diseases. This is like pre-MDS. Maybe they're going to have MDS next year or in the following year. And how worried should we be? Well, if the bone marrow looks normal and the chromosomes look normal and they have low blood counts, maybe it's not even MDS. So we'll call that ICKS. And if the bone marrow looks normal but the chromosomes look abnormal, well, being a little bit more worried, maybe we'll call that CHIP. And if the bone marrow looks, you know, so you can start, bone marrow looks abnormal, looks normal, the counts are abnormal, the genetics, we're going to call that CECUS. So these are ways to sort of pre, before the person even comes to see us. And as a hematologist, a blood doctor, this is, I see a lot of this. Because people get sent to us because they have low blood counts and we're trying to figure out what they have. So we don't label everybody with MDS unless we see the abnormal bone marrow. Now, who gets MDS? Unfortunately, it's older people. This is a disease of the elderly. And actually, I've given this talk and I said it's not just the elderly, but it's the uber elderly. It's the old people disease. As you can see, the incidence goes up as you get older and older. I almost never see it under people under the age of 60. I mean, you're talking about less than 15%. And if you say, get out of the pediatrician's office, you know, those congenital ones would show up right away. Once you hit about 15 years old, you're not going to see an MDS from 15 until you're 60 some odd years old. We don't see it in those age, unless they work in the gasoline industry or something. And then you say, this is the one that got caused by that poison. So unless, you know, you're a Robin Roberts and you got chemo and we can actually definitely trace it why that person got it, you know, this is a disease of the elderly and actually the older, because as you get to 80 and 90s, it goes up and up and up. And so it actually becomes the most common blood disease in the elderly. It's not the most common blood disease across the board, but as you get into the elderly, it becomes the most common. So how many patients? 10,000 a year is what the official government statistics are. Put that in perspective, 200,000 cases of lung cancer. So for every one of you, there's 20 people with lung cancer. Okay, so it gives you, this is a rarer disease. Now, it's probably not as rare, and we did a study at our institution, 8 years ago, I'm feeling old. 8 years ago, and actually probably did it about 10 plus years ago, that said it's more like 40,000. And the reason it's probably more like 40,000 is that there's a lot of people who are sent to me for working up their blood counts. And I can't make a diagnosis, or I don't want to make a diagnosis. If I have an 85-year-old who comes in with a little bit of an anemia, and I said, well, you might have MDS, but I'm not going to treat you even if I find it. And the only way I can find it is by sticking this horrible needle into your butt. They may say, I don't need that. I don't need just to know the name. So a lot of times we don't make a diagnosis because it's not going to change our treatment. Or it may be just that they're missing a vitamin or things like that and we didn't find the reason. So it's probably well underdiagnosed. And often that's not bad. It's no reason to make a diagnosis just to put a name on something if we're not going to do anything about it. Now recently, once again, the little star, we've gotten a way to be able to figure out the genetics without sticking needles in people's butt. So we can do these genetic tests from the blood cells because it turns out those damaged factories make damaged blood. And even though the white cells look normal in the microscope and actually usually do work, they have damaged DNA in them from the original. So we can take out that blood and do very fancy genetic tests. These are like $3,000 or $4,000 tests and actually find the genetic mutations in the blood without having to stick a needle in somebody's hip. So this is where the field may be going for molecular diagnosis. Now, not only does the molecular diagnosis help us say, oh, there's a damaged cell, but we can start to see those genetic mutations in the cell and start to classify them into different things that those genetics do. So we heard somebody talk about SBF, very common genetic mutation seen in a specific type of MDS called RARS. So as we get these genes, we're starting to see that they're not random. They're occurring in certain patterns with certain ways that the bone marrow looks. So different ways that the cell may look under the microscope have a different gene pattern. And that may predict outcome. It may actually predict response. But actually, in the future, and I'll say here's the future, because it may actually say, can we attack this gene specifically? Can we take that gene out and mutate it and get it to be fixed? And there are experiments being done on several of these genes where we're specifically attacking that gene and seeing if we can turn that gene off and maybe cure that person's disease. Now, it won't work for everyone with MDS because you have to have that gene. So if this gene's only seen in 16% of patients, it's only going to work for those 16% of people who have it. But it turns out that this particular gene, although it's the most common, 16%, is actually seen in 70% of people with that particular RARS under the microscope look. TET2, on the other hand, over there, another common one, predicts response to 5-azacitidine, to Vidaza. So we may actually be able to say this gene, this drug, and that's where we're headed with this field. And so we can also use that genes to start telling us prognosis, as you heard Dr. Shah talk about, that we use that gene pattern to tell us what therapies might work, what the prognosis is, and we complement our old-fashioned chromosomes. So once we've looked under the microscope, this is what our pathologists tell us. They see the ugly bone marrow, which they have to see in order to call it MDS, and then they say, what's ugly about it? And depending on what's ugly about it, they give it a name. And this changed again 2 years ago. Every couple of years, the pathologists changed the names of the diseases just to keep us on our toes. And one of the big changes was they moved that CMML out to its own little category. That used to be lumped in with MDS. They moved it around. This is the technical name of what you have. So one of the things you may want to know just knowing is what kind of MDS you have. If MDS is a group of diseases, you probably should know what subtype, because these subtypes are treated differently. They do have different implications, prognosis, but this is the name that a pathologist can give you after looking under the microscope. But what I really care about, and what you should really care about, is not the name of it or the genetics, but what's the general philosophy and classification of disease? And so often we'll think about MDS as being two different types of diseases, groups of diseases. There's the low-grade diseases and the high-grade diseases. In the low-grade diseases, the problem is that usually a blood count is falling, either the red or the whites or the platelets. One of them is falling, and you don't have a lot of leukemia cells. So you're worried mostly about what are the side effects, what are the problems of missing that blood, and usually it's red cells. And then that becomes a quality of life issue. So our therapies are designed in the low grade to try to make somebody's life better, their quality better. If they're low red and that's the only problem they have, they don't have leukemia cells, so we're not worried about them moving, their disease getting angry, they don't have bad genes and things like that, it's just low red, and they're feeling tired, how do we get their red counts up so they don't feel so tired? Quality. What if red, whites, and platelets are all low? What if they're severely low? What if they have development of leukemia cells? What if they have bad chromosomes? That's higher grade. Now we're not worried just about the quality. We're still worried about the quality. But now we're worried about, this disease could actually kill them. So now we start to think about quantity. So you think of this disease as sort of, there's the quality patients and there's the quantity patients. Okay? And so we divide the diseases artificially into low and high grade. Now, to be a technical guy, we start then doing what's called a prognosis. And Dale showed you the International Prognostic Scoring System, or IPSS. And you can go online, plug in your data. If you have the Leukemia Society's book, it's written right in there with all the different scoring system. If you go onto the MDS website, you can plug in your data. They have the calculator on their website. You can plug in, and you can get a score. But think of it simply, who's going to do better, a person who has just one low blood count, just red, or somebody who's got red, whites, and platelets? Well, the more factories they're broken, the more danger. So you get more points the more problems you have with your blood counts and how low they are. Who's going to get more danger, a person who has no leukemia cells or a lot of leukemia cells? So you plug in the number of leukemia cells, and you get more points. Who's going to get in more danger, the person who has a nice chromosome pattern or a bad chromosome pattern? You got to know which chromosome goes which. Well, the bad chromosome pattern does as well. So you plug in that, and that gives you the score. It's those three elements. How many factories are broken, and how bad are they? What are the chromosomes, and how many leukemia cells? And with that, we can start to say where you fall in the spectrum of your disease. Now, in addition to that, we're not just dealing with a disease. We're dealing with a person. And the person may have other problems, comorbidities. And one of the problems often with MDS is, you know, if we think just tunnel vision, what is the leukemia risk? And we forget the fact that the patient has had a heart attack and got diabetes and all these other problems. So we have to sort of then go back and say, step back and look at the whole person. Because that may influence what we're able to do or what we should do. So you have to start thinking about what are the other comorbid conditions. And I have often joked to my nurse, but not really a joke. In my practice, the single most greatest prognostic factor for a patient is whether they have a caregiver who can drive them. I mean, whether they have a caregiver who can drive them. Because if they can't come to the office, they don't get blood transfusions and they don't live. So it's maybe something simple like social things, which may not be so simple for you guys, that can make all the difference. And that doesn't show up in the scoring systems. So we have to think about the whole person when we think about MDS. We have the disease part, but then these other things like comorbid conditions, other therapies that they have, other social problems, cognitive problems. I have a woman right now I'm taking care of who has advanced Alzheimer's disease. I can't offer her a bone marrow transplant. She's otherwise healthy. She's young enough that she can have it, but she can't be able to do anything to be able to care. I mean, she's living in a nursing home because she's so advanced with her Alzheimer's. So if I tried to put her through a bone marrow transplant, she wouldn't remember to take her medicines and I'd hurt her. So the whole person has to come into the play here too. So how do we go about treating it? So we look at the type of disease, how bad it is, what the risk is, the models, what else we can do, and then we start to come up with a therapy. And the therapies often are divided by the lower risk versus the higher risk. Lower risk, trying to think about how do we improve the quality. Higher risk, how do we change the course of the disease to make them live longer. And they blend together. Well, the first thing is most people have anemia. Most people have low red counts as their problem. And this may not be well tolerated as people get older also. And so we have to talk to them, you know, what anemia, what hemoglobin level makes them feel well? And this is where you guys have to help us. Because I will have my hospital say, give blood transfusions above 7, but don't give them above that. And for many people, that's enough. But if somebody's trying to do something and they come in and say, look, 7 ain't cutting it for me. I can't do the things I want to do. Well, tell us that, and we'll make the trigger 8. And then we'll see if that works. And if 8 works, great. If 8's not working, let's give you a couple extra transfusions to get to 9 and see if that's the number that helps. But if somebody's doing great at 8, why bother wasting blood and giving up to 9? So tell us where you feel good. And then we also have to talk to the heart doctors to say, from the heart standpoint, what can their heart tolerate? If they've had triple bypass, the heart doctors don't usually want the blood counts to be low because they know that there's just a little bit of, you know, they need all the blood that is to, so they don't have a second heart attack. So we have to work with the other doctors. This is a fancy slide basically showing you that as the red count falls, fatigue goes up. Somebody had to do that study. Okay? So we give a blood transfusion, and typically in the beginning, 1 pint of blood should raise your hemoglobin about 0.8 to 1. So if you walk into the doctor's office and you have a hemoglobin of 8 and they give you a pint of blood, the next day or two, if they repeat test you should be around 9. Now, over time, that may not happen because your body may get used to that foreign blood and destroy it. So we get hemolysis. So now the red count goes from 8 to 8.5. You get less bang for the same amount of blood because your body's starting to destroy other people's blood. But roughly 1 point is 1 pint. There are some other things in here that we can talk about or you can have in your slide deck. You know, who do we use? If we think we might be going down to using a transplant in the future, we want to stay away from brothers and sisters giving you your blood. We may want to try to get rid of certain infections that are in blood in people who are going to transplant. Many hospitals will also radiate the blood first so that it doesn't cause any genetic sort of rejection type problems. So this is why it sometimes takes an extra hour or two to get the blood, because you have to find the right kind of blood. Somebody who's been heavily transfused may start rejecting other people's blood, so now you got to find really the one that fits, and then you have to then radiate it at the spot. So, okay. Now, there are complications from getting blood over and over again. This was to your question earlier. This is a study I did a couple of years ago, and we basically found that people who were heavily transfused, people who were heavily transfused had higher rates of heart attacks, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of liver problems. Why those problems? Because blood has iron in it. Blood is very rich in iron. And so as the blood transfusions continue, we're making you feel better, but we're also hurting you. Blood has iron in it. The iron goes in. As you heard from Dr. Shar, the body doesn't want to get rid of iron because it doesn't know. And so it will hold on to that iron forever and ever. And so we start putting extra iron into people, and that extra iron starts depositing in all these organs. And that can cause damage to those organs, specifically heart failure, diabetes, thyroid problems. And thyroid problems, the ones I actually, because people say, well, I've been had MDS for a while, and when I get my blood transfusion, I don't feel much better. In fact, I'm more tired now than I ever was. Well, maybe the blood counts are going up, but maybe all that iron has damaged the thyroid, and thyroids make people feel fatigued. So it's amazing how many times at the one-year mark when I'm following patients, I draw a thyroid panel as part of my MDS workup, and I find that the person's thyroid levels are low. Hypothyroidism, half the people in this room are probably on Synthroid, and very common as people get older, but the doses need to be regulated and go up as the transfusions go up. Then you're definitely on thyroid medications, and it probably doesn't affect you, right, for that. Okay, but these are things that we have to think about, and so we can try to remove the iron, and this gets into a little controversial. Yes, we know it damages, but does removing it make it better? And so the group from Texas actually did some studies where they think that they could sort of show that the people who were paying attention to the iron, giving them medications to get rid of the iron, seem to have better organ tolerance, but this still, gets debates. I'm actually somebody who believes in taking out the iron, but there are other doctors who are very smart doctors who think it's not going to make a big difference. But it gets there, okay? Okay, so that's the blood transfusions. So what can we do besides just giving people, covering up the problem by giving blood? Can we get those factories to make a little more blood? Well, the first thing you if you've got a dying plant, put a little fertilizer on it. Maybe you can squeeze some more blood out of it. And we have fertilizers, so-called growth factors. The red cell ones are called Procrit and Aranesp. Those are the brands. So many of you probably started with that, because that's actually one of the first things we often start with, is give people a shot of basically a fertilizer that's normally made by the kidneys. Erythropoietin is the technical name for that. EPO is made by the kidneys. It's the chemical in our body that makes to tell our bone marrow to make blood. If I were to cut myself and bleed a pint on the floor, my kidneys would figure out that I'm down a pint, and my kidneys would tell my bone marrow to make extra blood. And once I got enough to enough, kidneys would shut down and give me less EPO. So if we give somebody extra red cell fertilizer, we make extra blood. And that's usually the first step. Now, it's very heavily regulated by Medicare rules, and the Medicare rules in New Jersey are different than they are in Florida, so my patients who go back and forth for the summer have different numbers that they're allowed to get it at, because Medicare is by state, actually. And also, your Medicare rules for Procrit use in New Jersey are different than they are for breast cancer patients or for colon cancer patients. So often the doctors will say, I can't give Procrit because you're above 10. Well, that's true if you're colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer. It's not true in MDS. In MDS, the number is 12. So it's very different. And a lot of the doctors who don't see a lot of MDS don't know the difference in that little caveat there. I was signed a whole bunch of things years ago when Medicare was doing it. We were part of the group that got that Medicare to revise their rules. Okay? In addition, as you heard a little bit from Dr. Shah, sometimes you add a little white cell fertilizer, not because you care about the whites, but because two fertilizers may be better than one. And there's a specific type, that RARS, that ring sideroblast type MDS, which is about 15% of MDS, where red cell fertilizers don't work, but red and white together will work on that disease. So we will often give the reds, and if the red's not working, we'll add a little white, or in that one, you're supposed to start with the dual right out of the way. Okay? And that's actually one of the ones, once again, the experts know that. The people who don't treat a lot of MDS may not realize that little caveat there. Okay? White cell fertilizers, yeah, we have them. Brand name Neupogen. You see Onproc, they advertise on TV all the time now for as a way of giving white cell fertilizers the next day. We typically don't use them because we are worried that if you keep pushing the white cells, you may push it to be white cell leukemia. So we don't use that a lot prophylactically. But if a person gets an infection and ends up in the hospital, well, I just need the white cells back as much as possible. I'll use it then. Okay? And then platelets, clotting, there are a couple of them, Promactin and Plate. We're still trying to figure out, should we use them? The early studies were a little bit concerning because when you used N-plate, you actually saw leukemia develop. But then when we stopped the N-plate, all of a sudden the leukemia disappeared. So maybe it wasn't really leukemia. We were just fertilizing the blast and making it look like leukemia. So they stopped the studies early, Now they're rethinking that, and so there are studies going, especially with the Promactin, which is the pill, a pill platelet, pill one for platelets, that are starting to come back. So we may start seeing that in the next couple of years. The group at MD Anderson in Houston has been using these drugs in people with very low platelet counts when they're giving chemotherapy. We're giving Vidaza or Dacogen, which we'll talk about in a minute, you know, to get the people through the first cycle or two. So this is an evolving area, the platelet area. It's actually one of the problems we've had in MDS. Okay?
What about
get there. No, I'm good. Okay. So in Procrit, we can actually figure out, before we even start, who it's going to work on. And the idea is that if you haven't had a lot of transfusions and your kidneys aren't really over-functioning, well, then you're probably going to respond. So you can sort of make some predictions, and it, you know, helps us sometimes in figuring out which should we bother even wasting 8 to 12 weeks. And it's usually 8 to 12 weeks. You put fertilizer on your favorite plant, you don't come back 2 minutes later and see the fruit on the ground, right? You have to put the Procrit in and then wait 8 to 12 weeks before you're going to start to see the red cells making getting better. And then once they are, you may continue the Procrit on and on and on, weekly, monthly, every other month, depends on how much that person needs. I have some people have to come in weekly, because if they miss a week or two, all of a sudden the counts drop. And I have some people come in once a month, and that's enough to keep their plants going. So everybody's a little different. And over time, as the plants continue to disintegrate, because this is not fixing the problem underneath, it's just squeezing blood out, over time this will stop working. But how long is different. So it does work in older elderly. That was a question that was asked, and studies have shown that it doesn't matter your age. Now, there are new versions, essentially, of Procrit and Aranesp. Those are the two brand names. Okay. And the newest one is the one out here on the right that Celgene just bought the rights from an ACE company. I can't remember the name of the company, but basically this is essentially a new version of a red cell fertilizer. And the early studies have been fairly dramatic and fairly good, especially in people who have that RARS type. In fact, in that group, 70%+ of people are responding. So it may be that for that particular MDS type, this drug really works. For other lower grade MDSs, where we're only caring about the reds, and they're not worried about leukemia and things like that, it actually works okay. And so this is something that is moving forward fairly quickly. The phase one and phase two studies, which is the early development, are now completed. And they are launching the large national randomized phase three. Phase three studies are what the FDA requires to get a drug on the market, which is where you compare it against something else. In this case, I think it's against placebo. So, you know, and looking at how many transfusions people need. So this is probably on the fast track, if it holds up, to being something that's in the clinic in the next year or two. So this is moving ahead. Now, I know in the pre-questions that came out, somebody said, well, I'm trying to get this drug off, you know, from the company by compassionate use. And the answer is, I'm not sure they're going to give it to you, because they're doing a randomized national trial to get the drug on the market. And so why would they steer people away from a trial that they need? Now, there is the right to try government stuff that President Trump put through. New Jersey, by the way, does not have that law compared to other states. But if it goes federal, we will. Once again, this probably doesn't fall under that, because the right to try has to do with people who are terminally ill. And I already said this is low grade, so they shouldn't be terminally ill. And people who aren't eligible for the study, well, they should be eligible for the study in order to get this drug. This is a low grade supportive care drug. Probably doesn't fall under that category. Now, with that said, drug companies can do whatever they want, but you know, this is one where we will have a randomized trial, and I would encourage, if you're thinking about this, call one of the centers, because probably you guys will be doing it. I know we're going to be doing this study. So there is here in New Jersey. Okay, but this is a fertilizer for reds. Okay, what do you do if the fertilizers aren't working? You try something else, like a chemo. And the chemo pill that we typically use is a drug called lenalidomide, brand name is Revlimid, and is a gentle chemo. It basically stimulates the red cell factories. Now, it's a red cell drug. It's not going to make the whites go up. In fact, it'll make the whites get worse. It may make the platelets get worse. But it's a drug that stimulates the red cells to produce. It's a cousin of an old drug called thalidomide, which from You may remember for the babies who were being born in the 50s. And so it has a lot of regulations around it. You can't give this drug out willy-nilly. You have to call the company every single month and saying, I'm not pregnant, I didn't give it to any pregnant women, nobody in my family is pregnant, nobody touched it who's pregnant, never heard of pregnancy before. But we don't want babies being born. We don't let the nurses touch this drug. Okay, this is a real dangerous drug. But if you happen to have MDS and you're low grade, it will work. And it's FDA approved if you have chromosome 5 broken. So a very specific MDS that has a specific gene, if that's broken, 2/3 of the people will respond. 2 out of 3 people. Within 2 months, blood counts will get better. And many of those responses will last for years. I have one woman who is 10 years. I gave it to her for 3 months. She got better. We kept it on for 6 months. And then she said, I don't want to take this pill anymore. And 10 years later, before her blood count started to fail, we gave her again 3 more months, and she was back in remission again. So some people are very sensitive with the 5Q. However, if you don't have the 5Q, it's not approved. But it's not a bad drug. So within the last year, it doesn't work in the elderly patients. Within the last year or two, there have been studies now looking at the non-5Q, the other people who just have low REDS, and the bottom line is it works about 1/4 of the time. So it's not the 2/3 of the time, but 1/4 of the time still, 1 out of 4 people who can benefit. It takes a little longer. It takes about 3 or 4 months before you start to see it working, and it may only work for 1 year or so. So it's not as good, not as quick, not as long, but at least it's a pill that you can take. And the side effect profile is pretty not bad, you know, if you're not pregnant. It's a little rashes, a little numbness in the fingers and toes. And so it is a reasonable, what I would call, low-grade approach, where we're trying to think about quality over quantity, because we're just trying to make the red counts come up. Okay? One thing. Now, one other thing, this is hopefully something doesn't happen for you guys, but I actually gave this talk, and somebody did come up to me and said, this is my dose, and I said, that's wrong. This drug is also used in multiple myeloma, another blood cancer, which is much, much, much more common than MDS. And so doctors who are not familiar with blood cancers, who have a whole bunch of people coming into their office with myeloma, and only 1 or 2 with MDS when they've used this drug, will often have been known to write the myeloma dose, which is 5 to 10-fold higher. So a lot of the side effects, if you go online, and I heard somebody say, I went online to check out my thing. They go online, 90% of the stuff you're going to read is wrong because it's all geared towards the more common use of myeloma with numbness in the fingers and toes and drops of counts. You know, this is a different drug, a different dose, so it has a different side effect. So make sure if you're reading about lenalidomide or Revlimid, make sure you're reading about it for the MDS type dosing and what it is. Immunosuppressive therapy, we heard somebody ask about that before. Well, if the bone marrow is being turned off because the immune system is killing it, why not just turn off the immune system and see if the bone marrow will wake up? As I put in my little icon, why don't we reboot the computer? So, you know, sometimes I just get frustrated, just turn it off, let it sit for a second, and start all over again. And sure enough, that can work for some rare patients with MDS. This is not the most common therapy, it's underutilized. But it also doesn't need to be utilized that often because most people don't have an immune pushed down bone marrow. They may have immune problems, but they don't have this. And what we think with this is that it really works in young people who get this disease. Remember I said it doesn't usually happen to young people. And it happens when they don't have leukemia, they have an empty type bone marrow, and they have this weird genetic problem called STAT, which is often seen with an HLA type called DR15. So if I see a person who's younger, who has maybe a family history, or they have autoimmune diseases, they have a bone marrow that doesn't look like the other ones, it's pretty empty-ish, I will do a genetic profile on them to see if they have this type. Because the treatment is not easy. This is Mr. Ed. It is the blood from a horse. So this is called horse serum from the 1940s and 1950s, and yes, it is actually made from a horse. The horse lives in Minnesota. We actually know there's only one stable in the country that does it, and from the bare stables, they take the blood out from the horse. They don't hurt their horses. These are very well taken care of. They take the blood. They take off the plasma. They ship it down to us. It's usually 4 or 5 day hospitalization to give this stuff. It's not an easy hospitalization, but basically it turns off the immune system, and then 3 or 4 months later, the bone marrow resets, and then some people can actually, I wouldn't say where they use cure, but actually can make a big, big difference. Very rarely used, but doesn't need to be used that often. Okay? Not the same as just giving a little cyclosporine, a little prednisone, a simple immune system. That doesn't really work in this disease. It was an old person. We used to do it years and years ago. And so you'll still see some of the older doctors, and occasionally I have, just give a little bit of immune medications like prednisone and cyclosporine to see if that'll do something, but we really don't see much response to that. Okay. What about treating the person who has low whites and low platelets? Unfortunately, that's been a gap for us, and we often have to say if that's the if you're low grade because you only have one problem, but your one problem is low platelets, don't really have a lot to offer you, unfortunately. So there we do think about moving right into more of the high-grade type treatments, but down-dosing the dose, giving a dose. So instead of doing a week-long therapy, we may give 2 or 3 days' worth. Doesn't work as well, but we often don't have many other options for these patients other than just watching them. Because they're low-grade, we may say you just watch them. So what if now the disease is not just low-grade? Maybe it's multiple blood factors that are broken. Begins of leukemia, bad chromosomes. So now we start thinking about not only quality, but quantity. And this is where we start to think about more aggressive therapies. So in younger, fit patients, this is where we think about trying to cure them with a bone marrow transplant. And for everybody else, we start thinking about the demethylating agents or hypomethylating agents. And I put here, this is a Category 1 recommendation. Category 1 recommendations from the NCNs basically mean if you don't do it or you don't offer it, you get sued. This is that strong. There's very few things that are Category 1 recommendations where you would say, look, if you don't offer a patient, regardless of age and everything else, the opportunity to at least hear about this, and I often will twist their arm to do it. And I had a very vivid case that I remember of an 80-plus-year-old patient who came to see me and talked all about he's had high-risk disease, and I talked about giving him a demethylating agent. And as he was walking out, the grandson came up and said, you're not giving my grandfather chemotherapy. And I said, you're wrong. Because it improves the blood counts, improves the quality of life, as well as improves the survival. I just said quality there. What happens to grandpa if he has no hemoglobin and he's tired and feeling weak? So giving the chemotherapy drug actually made him feel better than the people who didn't get the chemotherapy. So the randomized clinical trial done a decade ago, called the AZA-001 trial, was a head-to-head comparison of giving a weeks-long treatment of Vidaza, or azacitidine. This is given either as a needle stick or an IV infusion over a half an hour, 7 days in a row, and then repeating it next month, and repeating it next month, and repeating it next month, and we'll talk about that in a second. But repeating this drug monthly versus doing the best thing that they could do, which in most cases was just giving blood transfusions. Okay? And the bottom line is that the people who got this lived a lot longer, filled out their quality of how I'm feeling today a lot better, so and have much better blood counts, and Medicare pays for it. So this is like the triple win. Okay? These people felt worse, didn't live as long, didn't have good blood counts and all the objective things that we do. So we do this on everyone, and age doesn't matter, as I'll show you on the next slide. Please let me, because I'm not going to get finished. Okay? So age doesn't really matter. So in this type of case, you offer this to everybody. Now, 7 days in a row may be tough, so some hospitals have tried to change that. What about decitabine, the other brand? Decitabine, when it was studied originally, they gave the wrong dose in the studies. They gave a 3-day regimen, very high dose hospitalization. They didn't do what we currently do, which is a 5-day regimen. They also did something very, very different. And that, as I said, this continues on and on and on. And in the decitabine studies, they stopped it as soon as the person got better. So what happened? A whole bunch of people got better, they stopped the drug, and it all got worse. So they didn't show a survival benefit because they didn't, well, at the time we didn't know. And what we learned from the two studies is, since the drugs essentially work the same, we learned that we need to continue the drugs indefinitely for as long as they're working. So I have people who are on these drugs for 2 or 3 or 4 years. Now, I may spread the visits out, I may cut the number of doses, but we continue them working, continue on the drug as long as they are working. Now, stable, to me, is okay, because this is a progressive blood disease. your bone marrow is failing. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. So if I keep it where it is, that means it's working. And I've had people say, I'm not going to continue because I'm stable. Fine. What's going to happen 2 months from now? And then guess what? It doesn't work a second time. If you take a long break, it often doesn't recapture. So you don't want to come off these drugs if they are working. Okay? This shell says that actually there's no age effect. You can give this to 80, 90-year-olds. They tolerate it just as well. You may have to make a little dose of medication, but this is not an age. You should not have age discrimination here. So you have one drug that works okay. Maybe it works in 50, 60% of the patients. Doesn't work on everybody. Doesn't make everybody cured. It makes nobody cured, actually. Well, can we build on it by adding something to it? So unfortunately, we've tried to add things to it, and unfortunately, these haven't worked. And the big national study, which was completed last year, tried two of our best candidates, going back to Revlimid, which we already heard said, well, maybe two is better than one. Bottom line, didn't add anything. Try a new other compound that called Vorinostat, which actually is used for skin cancers, but actually makes Vidaz and Dacogen work better, at least in the test tube it does. In real life, it didn't do anything. So the idea that adding something to it, you know, having Vidaza or Dacogen, which seemed to be working, and, you know, add something to it, didn't do much. Forgot to answer your question. Yes, these drugs not only made people live longer, but they actually slowed the progression to leukemia. They actually get rid of the blasts. And so sometimes, especially in a younger patient, you'll hit them harder with even higher doses of Dacogen, the cytobine, to get rid of the leukemia cells so that they can get rid of all the leukemia cells in preparation for a future transplant. So we tend to be a little more aggressive Dacogen, maybe gets rid of the leukemia cells a little bit better, but maybe doesn't do the blood counts as good. It's a little balanced there. So just when I was about to say adding a drug to it doesn't make a difference, last week, ASCO. So ASCO comes out, that's our big cancer meeting, so you couldn't find your doctor last week, that's why. And they were all down in Chicago for our annual meetings, and a drug called venetoclax, which is FDA approved for the treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. Common drug to use there. When you add that to Vidaza or you add that to Dacogen, all of a sudden we're seeing people have clean-looking bone marrows. A big break. Now, this was being done mostly in people who were very high risk for acute leukemia or already had leukemia. We don't know really what it's going to do when the average MDS patient in anemia 2, but a lot of excitement, especially in the higher end. The person who's MDS who's about to become leukemia, seems like it may turn the corner. So this now is what's called a high priority. The FDA put it as a priority review. In other words, get this thing moving. We may have something here that's really a big break. The drug's already on the market, so safety is not too much of an issue. I mean, so it's, you know, it's not like we're starting to square one. We have a drug that's already on the market. FDA already likes the drug. See if a combination actually may do something. So you may see a lot about this. So pay attention to this drug if you have the higher risk ones. Can we also, so two may be better than one. The guy said it wasn't, but we might have an answer. Can we make that one drug work better? Can we give it as a pill? Can we make it longer acting? Can we make it so that it doesn't get destroyed? And the answer is we have all those. MDS-006 is a study that Celgene was doing with an oral version of Vidaza. Looking okay, a little bit GI toxicities, but studies are going on. We may have a pill version. Guadefis, I can never say it, SGI-101. This is a long-acting version of decitabine. So you get one shot and it lasts for weeks. And maybe consistency. Remember I said continuing month after month? Maybe if you give a drug that stays in the body longer, 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 that may make a better response. Or this one, Aztecs 277. This is plain old decitabine in a pill version, so now a pill decitabine, in combination with a drug that makes that drug hang around, doesn't get destroyed. So this is trying to build on those two drugs that work, make them longer. Okay? Then there are new drugs completely that are not on our category of what we often use. Rigosertib, I know, is a study you guys have done, and we tried also. This is a pill, it's a novel compound, completely different than everything, been looked at in people who have failed Vidaza or Dacogen. What do you do next? If those drugs aren't working, maybe we can try a brand new compound. This compound has sort of gotten there. It comes back, and it just won't go away. It's not going to be a home run, but I'd rather be on the red curve than the blue curve as far as how long I'm living. So therefore, we want to be thinking about that drug. And then there are a whole host, and I've just put three or four of the most, what I would call promising, but I will tell you that every hospital has two or three that they're doing themselves, that they may get contacted, that some of them that they're inventing. Robert Wood Johnson is very well known for inventing or doing early phase one, which is like the first ones in humans. We tend to do a lot more of the second phase two studies where they've already been out there for a little bit of time, or we're playing to see efficacy. But these are where you talk to your doctor and say, is there something else out there? And I don't even bother writing the names down because they change every couple weeks. So, you go onto the line, you say, what's available now? And we may have five slots, and once the fifth person is in, we don't get any more. Because the drug company may say, you can only do this many at your hospital in this manner. So these constantly change. Fortunately, you live in a state that has a lot, and you also have New York City right near us where it has a lot. So there are often experimental compounds for people that are not fitting the studies. What about immune therapy? You hear about this on TV all the time. I had lung cancer, I got this new immune therapy, and I'm living. And the answer is yes, she is living. And my patients with lung cancer and colon cancer that I cover for because I don't take care of it, but my lung cancer doctor tends to take a lot of days off. So I end up seeing a lot of his patients. And these drugs really are the real deal. The Optivos and the Nevos and things like this. This immune wave that you're talking about on if you go into cancer sites is real. So unfortunately, in heme malignancies, that they really have not panned out. So far, almost all the studies have been failures. So there's something different about our diseases where these may not be the things. There are studies ongoing. We're not going to give up on them. At our center, we're actually looking at post-transplant as a way of trying to reduce relapse because we've changed the immune system in the patient with after transplant. Maybe we can then augment it. But I wouldn't be putting my dollar on this one. Okay? And then lastly, transplant. So what is a transplant, and why can't I have it, and why should I have it? Well, in a bone marrow transplant, we basically say the bone marrow is shot. Let's just get rid of it and replace it with a good one. Very simple idea. So here it is. It's aggressive, but it potentially can cure it. A couple things are, though, we have to have a donor. First off, we have to be healthy enough, and we have to have a donor. So finding a donor is often the first step, and figuring out if we have somebody whose bone marrow will like living in our body, that we can replace one bad bone with another. So after we will talk to our brothers and sisters, and we will match 1 in 4. It's just a genetic, you look like your siblings. There's four genes that two genes that you sort of, so 1 out of 4 chances you'll match your sibling. You don't match your children, they're only half you. But within the last couple of years, we've learned how to do those half matches. Those are called haploidentical transplants. It's a new rage in the field, and it's actually replacing a lot of stuff. So there's been a huge revolution in bone marrow transplants to allow us to do these half matches from children or from brothers and sisters who aren't perfect matches. And we're getting pretty good results with that. It had to do with switching the order when we give the cells versus the chemo. And then we also search for unrelated donors. And so you see Robin Roberts is actually now a spokesman for the National Marrow Donor Program. Volunteer to give your bone marrow to somebody else. After we find the donor, we bring the patient into the hospital, and it's usually about a 1 month hospitalization to do a bone marrow transplant. So these are not easy things. The first week is what's called the conditioning chemotherapy, where we give chemo to destroy that bad bone marrow. So we are now talking about poison, chemo, not the stuff that I was talking about where people feel better getting it. This is bad stuff. This is the chemo that basically wipes out your hair, your mouth, your stomach, and everything else. Now, recently we've talked about mini transplants. Mini, that's just my term. It's not what patients tell me. It's less chemo than I did 10 years ago. So that's why I think of it as reduced intensity or mini. But mini to me doesn't mean the same thing as mini to my patients. To my patients, it still means a lot of chemotherapy. And we really blast them to destroy that bone marrow. We get better results if they don't have a lot of leukemia cells in there. So often we'll give some Dacogen first or Vidaza first to decrease the leukemia cells before we bring them to the transplant. And also while we're looking for a donor. Okay? But then you give chemotherapy, destroy that bone marrow. Putting the cells in is easy. It's a blood transfusion. So we don't have to stick them in the hip. They will know, they know where they belong. Put them in any blood vessel, they'll find their way there. They start growing back. It usually takes them about a month to grow back, which is why the people are in the hospital, because for that 1 month, they have no functioning bone marrow, which means that they're getting blood transfusions every day. And they're in an isolated ward, and they're on antibiotics round the clock to keep them alive until that happens. Once the new bone marrow takes, though, it starts growing. We've replaced their bad bone marrow, the good one, and now they can go home, and hopefully they're cured. But then we have to worry about, do those new cells like living in their home? And that's called graft versus host disease, which is rejection, which is the leading reason why these don't work and people die. Because if those cells don't like living in their new home, they will attack it just like a germ. My white cells know me. They know what I look like. They float around. They bang into all my organs, and they're happy. But if I get a cut and a germ gets in there, that germ looks different than me. They don't like different things. They kill it. If I put my white cells in my sister, she doesn't look like me. Those white cells will look at that my sister's skin and say, that doesn't look like me, and they'll kill her the same way that they would kill a germ. The whole purpose of matching is to get my cells to like living in the new person's home. If we can do that, we've replaced a bad bone with a good one, we cure the person. If we don't, this can be really miserable. So when do we do it? We tend to do it when people are sick. We don't do it in the beginning because the risk of the transplant is too high. We don't want to do it at the end because then it's too late. So finding that sweet spot, and so you get these curves that maybe at intermediate two is where you want to hit the person. They're not all at high risk on that scoring system because they might die. They're not too early that you don't take risks. And so we now have done this study. We're looking at, in older patients, when's the right time, and it seems to be intermediate two. Transplants are being done. This is data from this year, or actually the most recent update from the International Transplant Registry, showing it's the fourth most common reason to have a bone marrow transplant in the United States. So it's not that we don't do them. We do a lot of them. It's the fourth most common. How do people do? About half the people are cured. If you do them earlier in the course of the disease versus later in the course of the disease, you're running about half of the people being cured. And when we look at older patients, you know, the 70s and 80s, we have done. We've done people in their 70s. We get a little bit nervous at 80. But we've done people in their 60s and 70s. 60s is certainly the most common reason to do it. Most of those people who had the transplant are in their 60s. You get into the mid-70s and they're healthy, that they can get through that month, then you can start talking about it. And generally, we talk about one-third of them being cured, one-third of them dying from infections, graft versus host disease, and other things, and one-third of the time, unfortunately, the disease comes back. We didn't kill all of your bad cell. So that's where the dacogens before, and maybe dacogens after. So Sloan Kettering actually thinks that everybody should get decitabine for a whole year after the transplant. So we're learning on this stuff. Geriatrics, you can see this is in the older population, 60 plus or more. Many of these people were in the 70s. You can still see that you can help some people. And so finally, my last slide, the quick turn, I know went through a whole bunch of stuff, but the question is, that's what we can do for you. The question is, what can you do to help yourself and what can you do to help us? And if people ask me that, I always have the same answer. Talk to us. There are so many patients that don't know what we have to offer or don't utilize all the services because they don't tell us. I have a very nice gentleman I took care of for years. He used to come in every day, elderly gentleman, old-fashioned, where he would wear a suit and tie every time he came in to see me. And he would come in with his wife, and they were both in their 80s, and they would get an Uber back and forth. And then one time his daughter came to me and says, you do recognize that he doesn't get out of bed all week. The only time he comes to see you is when he gets dressed for you. And I said, I didn't know that. And because I didn't know that, I didn't give him more blood. So I thought he was functional. So the next week we had a long talk. We changed his whole regimen to give him the energy he needed because I was keeping his hemoglobin at the wrong number for him. But he didn't tell me that. So tell your doctors how you feel. If you're not feeling good with a hemoglobin of 7, tell us and we'll make it maybe 8. If we're not doing what you want, tell us what you want. There are people that say, look, if I don't get cured, then I don't care about this disease. Well, then we'll talk a lot more about a transplant and whether it's right for you. Okay? And whether those risks of one-third dying may be the right risks. Okay? It depends on what you want, but you have to tell us. Also tell us if you need help, because there are groups like the Leukemia Society and MDS Foundation that will help us with Ubers and transportation that can make a big difference in how you think. But we don't know that. I'm a very good doctor, I'm a lousy mind reader, and I'm even worse at looking to see what you're doing in your home. My spy cams are not that good. So I don't know what's happening to you once you leave my office. And if you don't tell us that, because this disease, most of it is quality, and quality happens outside my waiting room. So if you tell us that, we can give you ideas. And then some of the things that you want to know from today, hopefully you want to know what kind of MDS, where's your risk score, and those risk scores change over time. Have your doctor tell you that. That's stuff that everyone should tell you. So with that, thank you. I know I ran a little late. We're into lunch, but I'm going to hang around for questions afterwards. And I know Dale's still in the back, and we'll be glad to answer questions. And thanks for coming, and thanks again to the Leukemia Society and the MDS Foundation.